What up, peeps? Welcome into Unscripted and Unprepared, brought to you by Real Screen Magazine. I'm Jimmy Fox, and this episode is my sit-down. I still can't believe it happened. With Phil Rosenthal, the host of Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix, and of course, the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond. I'm still buzzing. To steal a line from the great George Costanza, I'm busting, Jerry, I'm busting. Phil was good enough to come on this podcast. We talked about Raymond. We talked about what led to Phil wanting to host a food show in the first place. We talked about his first steps into the documentary slash reality world with his documentary, Exporting Raymond. And as you're about to find out very early in this episode, this man is like a personal hero of mine. His book, You're Lucky You're Funny, had great, great impact on me and was a real moment. A real moment. I vividly remember getting through his book and being highly, highly inspired to not give up on my dreams of making it in this industry. So, and he had no idea when he came on this podcast, he had no idea of my personal history with his work and what it meant to me. And we had a nice chat after we were done recording this episode where I kind of expressed that to him. And I think he was touched. Thank you to Andrew Lear at UTA who set this up. It meant a lot. This is my sit down with the very funny, the very honest, the very down-to-earth, and highly successful Phil Rosenthal. I hope you enjoy it. All right, it's a Friday afternoon, and I'm talking to Phil Rosenthal. How great is this?
It's great for me. Nobody really likes talking to me, so this is nice.
Absolutely not true. 100% not true.
I meant in my house.
Inside your house? Oh, yeah. I know how that is. Yeah. I also have two kids, Phil, so I know how that is.
Listen, I tell everybody, I have the perfect level of fame right now. Once or twice a day, somebody comes up to me and says how much they like the show or even like me, and I don't get that in my house, so it's nice when I do get it.
Okay, so interesting conversation that took place in my house this morning, yeah. as it pertains to you. So I'm driving my 8-year-old, my oldest, to school this morning, nice. and I'm like, you know, Dad's a little nervous today because he has a very important person that's going to do his like monthly podcast today. And my 8-year-old daughter, she's like, "Oh, who is it?" And I go, "His name is Phil Rosenthal." And she goes, "Never heard of him." And she's 8 years old. So I go, "Well, honey, yeah, you know, he has this awesome show on Netflix that he hosts. And he also created this sitcom called Everybody Loves Raymond." And she goes, "You mean like the noodles?" And I go, "No, that's ramen, honey. That's
awesome."
So if you ever need a spinoff.
How many people have sent me packages of ramen and they've dummied in the name of ramen. Everybody Loves Ramen. Yes.
That's really happened?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Phil, I can't imagine how many pitches and things you must get on a daily basis.
Well, I actually thought of something. My friend Ki Kwan is now a very big star and has won every supporting actor award for the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once, right?
Of course.
And he's probably going to at least get nominated, if not win the Oscar, right? Yeah. His name in the movie is Waymond. So I said, "Well, I got to get you a shirt. Everybody loves Wayman, don't I?"
Something. Studio spinoff, something. Phone calls have to get made.
Right.
Andrew Lear, super agent to the stars.
He is.
He mentioned, "Hey, you know, Phil's going to be at Real Screen in Austin. And, you know, I think I could get him to do the podcast." He's like, "Would you be interested?" I'm like, little did Andrew Lear know how influential and inspiring your book You're Lucky You're Funny was for me.
Oh, I had no idea. That's so nice.
I'm not sure if you saw the email I sent him back, but
I don't think I got that.
I was an assistant at I was an assistant at NBC at the time working for Ben Silverman.
Oh,
and
God.
This is like 07.
Okay.
And I listened to the audiobook on CDs.
Yeah.
Through one long drive up to Northern California. It was like a critical book for me, like lighting my fire, actually inspiring me to chase entertainment dreams, Phil.
You mean and not work for Ben Silverman anymore?
Yes, to get off the desk and actually do my own stuff. But what's interesting, as you look at your career now and where you are now with the shows, you talk a lot about food in that book.
I do.
You were talking, and the importance it played on set, like setting the tone of the culture you were trying to build.
You know, I worked on a show before I got my own show, before I got Raymond. I worked on several sitcoms for other people.
Yeah.
And I was on this one show that will remain nameless. It was a hit show on a major network. And I'm talking about a big hit show that was in its fifth or sixth season.
I think I know what this is, but yes.
Okay.
Yes.
A memo went around the office building. I'm not exaggerating. With the show's letterhead on this official memo. And I never forgot what it said. It said, and this was in 1995, okay?
Okay.
This is how impactful it was that I remember it verbatim. This was the letter. We notice some of you are coming in the morning and putting milk on your cereal. The cereal is for snacks. The milk is for coffee. Please do not put milk on your cereal. We do not provide breakfast for you.
What?
I remember reading that and thinking, if I'm ever lucky enough to have my own show, we're going to have milk in our cereal.
at a minimum. But was this, what do you chalk that up to? Was this some overzealous like union thing about not providing breakfast, or was it just a straight budgeting a-hole thing?
I'm going to say it's just asinine.
Yes.
Just, you know how, and we see this in everyday life. You don't even have to be in show business to see this. Everyone is king of their kingdom. And if some office manager thinks he can save a nickel and that'll make him look good,
right,
he's going to write that memo.
Right.
And maybe it's even with the approval of the big guy. I don't know.
Right.
You have to think it has their approval because another memo wasn't following it, saying disregard previous memo. This was now the thing. Another friend of mine told me he worked on a show where if you had a title of producer or above,
mm-hmm.
you drank Coke, Pepsi, name brand, Dr. Pepper, sodas. If you were below producer,
oh, come on.
You had Shasta and the knockoff sodas. Yes.
You had the so Mr. Pibb for below producer,
exactly
Dr. Pepper for above.
For above producer. The line. Yes. How about that?
That's
what. So I made it a point not just to have name brand sodas and milk on our cereal, but you can ask anybody. I think we had the best craft service in town. It was very important to me. First of all, I enjoy food, as we know, but this is a great way to show people that you care about them.
Right.
And gender, not just loyalty, but the spirit of family.
That's right.
If you have nice food, if it's not just the craft service table that's filled with candy and chips and junk food, and people just go over there out of habit and just grab a handful of crap and eat it, first of all, not good for you. Second of all, that's what everybody does. It's the cheapest possible thing to do. But let's say, you know, you have a guy who's making fresh soups every day and fresh sandwiches. And beyond that, we order in food that's flown in from Chicago or New York.
Did you ever have to have a standoff with a line producer or a studio rep questioning the spend on food on set?
The line producer for Raymond said, you know, there's been some concern that maybe we're exceeding our food budget. I said, take it out of the set budget. That's how important it is.
That's right. That's
if I
right.
Have to, listen, most of the scenes took place in the living room and kitchen anyway. They were permanent sets.
That's right.
So I know we're not using spare sets this week. Put it into food.
Genius. Out of curiosity, did you ever read Brandon Tartikoff's book, The Last Great Ride?
Oh, I should, shouldn't I? But it's interesting.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And there's a moment in the book where he described the very moment he realized that Miami Vice was not only a hit, but something that had like penetrated pop culture.
Yes. Yes.
And it was a moment where he saw guys walking down the street with the jackets, with the pushed up sleeves, with the neon t-shirts, just like Don Johnson. And that was like the moment he realized, oh my God, we've really done something here.
We're in the zeitgeist. Yeah.
We're in the zeitgeist. Was there that, like, was there a moment that stands out to you where you just knew that Raymond wasn't just going to be a great show, but something that was like an instant classic that was going to live on?
I think this is in the book. You're Lucky You're Funny. First of all, I thought we might have something when I saw the cast read together for the first time, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But episode three. Now, when you start a sitcom in front of an audience, a four camera sitcom with a live audience, the audience obviously doesn't know the show for several episodes because it hasn't been on TV yet.
That's right. Right?
So you're taping sometimes 6-7 episodes without it ever have been shown on television yet. So every audience is new to the material, right? Maybe you can edit something together from the first episode to show that audience for the second or third episode so they're at least familiar with the characters and they understand it.
That's right.
But this was episode three. I don't think we had even the time to edit the first one. Maybe we did show them the pilot, whatever it was. This is episode three. And the audience, you know, is a combination of people from old age homes and prisons, sometimes in the same audience.
Because again, this is a new show. So you're kind of like getting
a show. It's not like they're lining up to see friends down the way. This is something they never heard of.
Yeah.
With people they never saw before.
Right.
Right. Maybe some savvy moviegoers recognize Peter Boyle.
Right.
Okay. They certainly didn't know who Raymond was and maybe barely knew who Patricia Heaton was. But there was a scene in episode three where Raymond is next to her. She's eating a bowl of ice cream and he says the wrong thing. And she just looks at him, takes her bowl of ice cream and turns it over on his lap. Okay. And he just sat there and the audience roared with laughter, not just at the physical gag, but at the relationship. This was a relationship laugh, a character laugh.
That's right.
It goes to the heart of what the show is, right?
Right.
That laugh went on and on and on for over 30 seconds. And I turned to one of the writers next to me, and I just said as a smart aleck remark, we're all going to be millionaires.
That's the moment.
When you feel the connection between the audience and what the characters are not even doing, but thinking.
Yeah.
And you can see in many cases, we would see that the audience was laughing at the straight lines, knowing
the anticipation.
There's so much, or we would just cut to someone's face and we had a good line waiting, but we would cut it in editing because we didn't need it because they already knew.
I know.
What Brad Garrett was thinking.
That's
about
what I was saying. The Brad Garrett laughs. The Brad Garrett laughs. It was those premature anticipation. And for the joke to then live up to the expectation in the moment.
Yes. And so these were character laughs. And there's what I loved always about the sitcoms I treasured. On the Family, right?
Yeah.
Mary Tyler Moore. You know, The Odd Couple.
Yeah.
Know the characters so well, the Honeymooners, that you know the way they've reacted before. You know them like members of your family. You know how they're going to react in certain situations, which makes it all the better. I also believe in adding some dramatic moments to the comedy because that grounds everything. You don't want to have very special episodes where, you know, God forbid somebody has a terminal disease. But you do want the occasional dramatic moments. It keeps everybody on their toes and lets them know that it's not just joke, joke, joke all the time, because that's not real. That's not believable. Nobody's life is like that.
Right. I mean, 200 plus episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond. And I was trying to look through your work and kind of decipher. And I think your first foray into unscripted was with Exporting Raymond. Am I wrong? Were you dabbling in the documentary space before that?
100% right. What happened right after Raymond was over was we got a call from the Russians.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to turn my sitcom. They wanted me to go over there and help them turn my sitcom into Everybody Loves Kostya.
I love this documentary, by the way, Phil. And I told Andrew Lear, I'm like, I don't know how this didn't become a franchise. I don't know how we haven't seen three other exportings since for other shows. It's fan, and it completely holds up, by the way. It's fantastic.
I got the nicest letter from Ken Burns of all people.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that he loved it. It's something quite unusual, I think. A comedy that's 100% real.
Right.
It's 100%. There's nothing fake or phony about it. I said I would go do it if I could document the process.
Okay, so that's how it came to be. So you,
that's it. The head of Sony called me into his office. He said to me that Sony invented the sitcom in Russia. It did not exist until The Nanny.
Okay.
And that became a hit. Then they had other things that didn't work, like Golden Girls they tried to do over there.
Mm.
What they realized was it wasn't relatable at all to the Russians, because there is no nice, sunny place for old ladies to gather.
I was going to say, like, what is the Miami equivalent?
There is nothing like it. So it didn't work. But The Nanny worked. Married with Children worked. But what they did was, as broad as those shows were in America, The Nanny and Married with Children, they made them even broader in Russia. Mainly because the only other types of comedy shows were either variety shows or sketch shows.
Hmm.
So that was the tack that they took with my show. Now, why they invited me over there to not listen to me at all is a question I'm still asking. But the show became so wildly popular, they made thousands of episodes. I have downstairs.
Oh, I did not know that.
I have a medal from the Guinness Book of World Records that this is the most successful adaptation of a show in another country in history. It spawned two spinoffs, a prequel and a sequel. It's insane.
Did you go back at any point after making the documentary?
No, but I did have a guy while it was, you know, being produced for years. Yeah. They asked for more help and I was busy. I couldn't do it, but I sent one of my senior writers, a guy who was now older, he was in his 70s, to go. His name was Jeremy Stevens. He's since passed away, but he went and really made it a hit by being way more of a diplomat than I was. I, like, why did you ask me here if you're not going to listen to me? That was my attitude.
Did they have any reservations about you putting them on camera and showing their Russian process of TV making? Was it a fight at any point?
No.
That's crazy to me.
Listen, people are crazy. You see who you see who shows up on reality shows, and you see who shows up on, you know, YouTube videos. They know they're being filmed. My own parents. They're in the film, right? That's the first use of my parents, right?
Yes.
I thought at the beginning of the film, you see me go to my parents' house and talk to them because I want, first of all, they've been to Russia. Mm. I thought that would be funny to get their perspective on Russia because I've never been and they can teach me a thing or two. And the audience will see where the parents kind of come from on Everybody Loves Raymond and who they're based on, right?
Yep.
They were somewhat based on my parents. So you show up with a camera crew. Two guys with big honking cameras, another guy with a boom mic, and then they wire my mother and father. You know, they slip a lav up my mom's front of her blouse. She's like, oh my. My father is like, I have to wear this on my ass, this battery. And I'm telling you, all this stuff, the cameras, the boom mic, the wire. Within 5 minutes, they were fighting as if nobody was there.
And what
it's the thing. People forget, or they don't care, or I don't know what it is.
Well, but we would
look at all the horrible behavior we see in these reality shows, right? Horrible. Yeah. Don't they know they're being filmed? Of course they do. They just either forget or don't care. You get comfortable.
Well, at this point. You make Exploring Raymond, and at this point, does it kind of like, did you catch the bug in terms of A, being on camera, but B, the producing and editing process and the making of that, the hands-on ability you have because I always say scripted is a writer's medium, movies is a director's medium, and unscripted is a producer's medium.
I would say producing and editing and writing happens in unscripted after it's shot.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean, we can make all our plans in the unscripted world, but stuff's going to happen that's going to happen. And
that's
if you're And if you're smart, you'll let it happen.
But was this the moment where you
go with it?
Was this the moment where you thought, I might want to host something?
No, I didn't. I just knew. I mean, I got a good response from that. And by the way, you should also know that before I turned to writing, I was an actor. I thought, you know, when I'm a child, I don't know that there's writing, directing, and producing. Right. I watched The Honeymooners and I go, they're funny. I want to be like them. And my parents were funny. And my dad, especially, I wanted to be like him. And everyone I saw on Johnny Carson, I wanted to be like them and be funny on stage. Well, the only way you can do that without being thrown out of class is to be in the school plays.
Right.
So that's what I did. And I was a very big star in high school. I was such a big star that they encouraged me to go to theater school for this, to go to major in drama. I mean, that's a very dumb move, but I enjoyed it. I went to Hofstra University and I was a very big star at Hofstra University. Then I moved to New York. They hadn't heard that I was a big star. Nobody told them.
The news hadn't traveled.
I was a little surprised that not everybody was waiting to put me in things. Right?
So you had to kind of put that part on pause for a while.
I absolutely did, until some friends of mine, and I'm talking about years after getting knocked around in New York, for years, terrible jobs, odd jobs, crazy jobs, eating tuna fish for dinner every night. You know, fun because I was pursuing what I loved and living a free life of without homework. I treasured it. This was New York in the 80s. This was dirty New York, right? This was, you know, get on the subway in August and you've been to the equator. So some friends of mine wrote a show, for a play for ourselves to be in. And that became very successful. And that was my transition to writing. That, and I wrote a screenplay with a friend of mine. And that also got sold immediately to HBO.
Oh, wow.
It didn't get made, but we got, you know, like $70,000 in 1988 for a screenplay. That was, I went from being a hundredaire to a thousandaire.
But I mean, do you look back now and think how crazy that was, that so soon into the process of trying to be a writer, you sold something to HBO?
Listen, sometimes life presents you with what you're supposed to be. So I'm not that stupid. I said, wait a minute. I'm now eating whatever I want for dinner. Right? So maybe I should pursue the writing a little more. So I came to Hollywood, got a partner. And we were hired within 6 months. We were hired on a sitcom. I know that's unusual, but I also know maybe I was meant to do that.
I was looking at the shows you had written on previous to Raymond.
Yeah.
How much had you gone through the pitch process of pitching your own original pilots? Because I know you staffed on a number of shows, but how had you been pitching and pitching for years trying to get original stuff made?
I think we pitched one before getting hired on a sitcom. By the way, that sitcom is a joke. I mean, this is true. Our first job in television was on the Robert Mitchum sitcom. It lasted 7 episodes. But like my friend said, what you can learn on your first show, you can learn on any show.
Right.
And this certainly was that. And you learn just as much of what not to do as you learn what to do. And they're equally important.
That's right. Well, I want to flash forward because I want to talk about your hosting work now. So the first iteration.
So after Raymond, I didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I thought, well, no, that's not true. I did think I'd make more sitcoms, but the business had changed so drastically that I was not, they didn't want what I do anymore. They just told me, just do hip and edgy, make it. Do
so even then, do. So even then, Phil, even then, like we're talking like what, this is like 2007?
Six or seven, yeah.
Even then, you saw the landscape of multicams change from like...
Absolutely. They thought Raymond was an anomaly. They always think these family shows are an anomaly. Listen, what was the next big family show that came along?
Modern Family?
That was 5 years later.
Right.
And before ours was the Cosby Show of the 80s.
Yeah.
It was the last big family thing, right?
Well, that and TGIF shows, right?
But they these are the building blocks of TV. They always have them. The four cameras to come. And of course, the dopes in charge think it must be the form that's bad. No more four camera.
Yes.
I'm like, no, it's the content, not the form.
Yeah. No, I have a theory, and I want to get your thoughts on this.
Please, I want to hear it.
Because I love, I mean, multicams, family multicams have such a near and dear spot in my heart. I feel like the primetime broadcast era of reality shows may have killed the family sitcom. Because I look at the landscape of what families, like my own, I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, me and my wife, what can we all watch on broadcast TV right now? And it's shows like, currently, I'm looking, if you look at the current landscape, it's like America's Got Talent, and American Idol, and Ninja Warrior. They're cheaper, they're hour long. Do you think that has something to do with that was like the way of networks thinking, okay, we can get the whole family four quadrant in with these hour long formats, and that somewhere along the way, single camera became in vogue, and that was always a more narrow school of comedy, like Arrested Development and others, at least for broadcast television? Is that what?
Here's what I said at the time, and we were doing Raymond at the time, when this glut of reality shows started coming up.
Right. This is the era. This is the era of CBS with Survivor and Big Brother and Amazing Race.
I was right there. And I saw it all happening. And I said, maybe this glut of reality shows signals something more than just a trend. And that could be the end of civilization.
Yeah. Do you resent reality TV in general? Or are there certain things you like?
I resent the bad ones.
Yes. Yes.
But I resented bad sitcoms too.
Yes.
And bad dramas. I resent bad everything.
That's right.
But there's always been, there's never been a golden age. There's always been more crap than good. That's just in every aspect of life. And that's how it's been forever. But, what makes something good is that it rises above the crap. But that's, you know, that's the top of the mountain.
Well, to your point, if there wasn't more crap than good, there wouldn't be so many new shows every fall. There wouldn't be enough slots.
I once said to the head of a network when he was deliberating what to put on the network, right?
Yeah.
He said, well, this one tested better. I'm like, yeah, but it's not good. I mean,
this is a story about CSI. I love this story so much.
Well, you'll have to, people will have to read the book to get it. But the gist of that is, what I'm getting to here is, I said to him, do you ever test the testing? He says, what do you mean? I said, well, 90% of everything that goes on the air craps out after two episodes. It's bad. And they all tested great, or you wouldn't put them on, right?
Right.
You ever test the testing? Well, can't say that to an executive. You know why? Because testing only exists as an ass covering. Testing only exists for them to point to. It wasn't my taste. It was the testing.
Right. It literally takes the decision out of their hands.
You got it.
Much more.
So everything. And if you've ever sat in a testing session, it's absurd. They turn the dial to the right when they like something and turn it to the left when they don't like something at every moment of every second of the show. So what happens is they turn to the right when there's a punchline and they turn to the left on the straight line. And then the writer gets a note, cut the straight lines.
Yes.
And when somebody they recognize because they've seen them before, turn it to the right. Somebody comes in, I never saw him, turn to the left. So then you get a note, fire that guy. We never saw him. I'm like, you're out of your minds.
So, but I wanted to talk to you because now you're in the Netflix family. And I'm sure having done six seasons.
Listen, we're one of the six seasons, right?
Yeah.
Somebody Feed Phil is one of the longest.
Yes.
It's in the top 10 of longest running original series in Netflix's history.
Yeah. I mean, I think I just for like frame of reference, I think I just read that like Cobra Kai is getting a sixth season and that is like, and it's final. That will be its final season.
Yeah.
And that's a big hit.
They want new stuff. The algorithm has dictated again.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is ass covering in their thing because I like Netflix very, very much.
Yes, we do.
This algorithm has said they will get more new subscribers with new series. Like if you see a new thumbnail poster on your screen all the time, and there's like three a day now, you will never cancel Netflix and you might even subscribe because it is an obscene amount of choices.
And it's a fear of missing out on what could be next.
Got it.
Yeah.
You got it. And even if they cancel your favorite show, it's still going to be there in some form. The thumbnail is still there. You don't know if there's two episodes behind that thumbnail poster or 200.
But you having spent so many years making a hit for like the most traditional of traditional studios and networks, right? With Sony and CBS.
Yeah.
And the whatever form of data they had to provide to you at the time, right? Compared to Netflix now, it must be it must be incredible for you to see the difference now in terms of when they explain to you how they're going to reach users. I mean, I sat through a Netflix explanation. We did a documentary for them that came out last summer, and they walked us through.
What was it?
And it's called Girl in the Picture. It's a true crime documentary.
Okay.
And they walked us through how they're going to reach certain users, how they have various different key art, and that key art will appeal to people to watch all different kinds of shows on the platform. It was my head was exploding. It was incredible. And I wasn't sure if, like, having now gone from traditional TV network to the Netflix model, if you've learned new things and been just as impressive as I've been in terms of how they reach people.
I've learned new things. I can't say I'm impressed. I see stuff like, you know, listen, TikTok is a miracle, right?
Yeah.
I it's not for me, right. but I'm on it. My daughter wants me on it. I have to dance with her once in a while.
Oh, you get on the, are you getting on the TikTok these days?
Doing whatever I can. You have to. So it's all, you know, a form of marketing, isn't it? But I don't get it. I don't get a lot of it. I really don't. There's a lot I don't like. Maybe it's the old man in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we, you know, had 200 episodes of a show, right?
Sure.
So about 6 seasons on Netflix, it's really only like 30 something episodes.
It's like 33 episodes, I think, so far.
We almost did that per season on Raymond. We did 24.
That's the thing. I mean, you can't miss that life of 20 plus episodes a season. Do you miss that aspect?
I can't say I miss the show, because I feel like we did it.
Right.
But I miss my friends, and I miss laughing every day in a writer's room. There's no better life in the world than that.
Yeah. It's like summer camp, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, so I had that for 9 years, and then there was a 10-year period of struggling.
Mm.
Until I shifted,
right,
and thought I might have something to offer in this food and travel space. And after 10 years of trying to get something on, I finally hit it with one line as a pitch. I walked into PBS after going to all the other Food Network, Travel Channel, finally went to PBS, and I sold the show with one line. And the line was, I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
Yes, that's right.
And they said, we've been looking for a food and travel show with humor for years. So after 10 years, I was in the right spot at the right time. But even my agents, you know, you walk into your agent's office after having a little success on a sitcom and say, you know what I'd like to do now is a food and travel show. They look at you as if you've murdered their parents in front of them.
I know they're thinking of their future commission checks, and they're thinking that's not.
There's no money in that. They said,
yeah.
I said, I'm not really doing it for money.
Yeah.
They said, well, why are you wasting our time? Where would you like to do this show? I said, PBS. They said, why don't you just set fire to the building?
but I watched the Austin episode of Somebody Feed Phil, and you mention it in the voiceover about when you took the pitch out to Food Network.
That's
and you also had to do the rounds at Travel Channel. And this was like in the heyday of cable, you know, of basic cable.
This is in the 2000s. In the 2000, what would it be?
14?
Yeah.
Because I'll Have What Phil's Having comes out in 2015, right? So it's about 2014 era, right?
But it could have been earlier because, as I said, 10 years of selling.
So for you, again, like, forget the agents for a second.
Yeah.
Talking about just like the network TV, you know, car wash, as they say, when you're taking out the pitch.
Yeah.
You are Phil Rosenthal, who has created one of the most successful sitcoms of all time. And here you go walking into you know, Travel Channel and TLC and places like this.
That's
and
right.
Food Network. And you have, as a storyteller, you have amazing taste. You're probably thinking, I'm going to walk into these rooms and I'm going to be one of the biggest gets that they've had come in. And you were met with like indifference on the food side of things, right?
I can't say that I expected anything.
Okay.
I would never have that hubris. And by the way, I had one success after Raymond, every pilot I wrote was rejected. Everyone. Everything they sent me was terrible. I used to say my agent says I can work anytime I want as long as it's on something terrible. And I just didn't want to be part of it. And I thought, if I'm going to bang my head on this wall of show business, I'm going to pick a spot in the wall that I'd really like to bang my head against.
That's
and
right.
so I started on the food and travel thing. And it was all inspired by, this is already an old story, by an episode of Raymond when we went to Italy in that show. And
oh.
I saw Ray Romano, the actor, the person,
yeah,
actually get transformed by the magic of travel. And I thought that was fantastic. And I thought if I could do this for him, maybe I could do this for other people. So that stayed with me. And even while I wrote the book, You're Lucky You're Funny, I made Exporting Raymond, in the back of my mind was this dream job of maybe doing a funny take on what Anthony Bourdain does. With what, like a guy who's decidedly not a fearless hero, daredevil.
I just finished his book. I just finished Kitchen Confidential, and I was kicking myself for not having read it sooner.
It's excellent.
But in real life, like knowing that your pitch was, you know, if Anthony was afraid of everything.
Yes.
Are you a good traveler? Because I'm kind of a nervous guy, and I don't love traveling. Like I don't love flying and things like that. So yeah, does your fear only equate to trying exotic foods, or does it permeate? Why
I have, like everyone else, I have a fear of the unknown. But now that I've done this now for a bit, I know more. It's not unknown to me, a lot of the stuff. Maybe a country that is so wild that maybe I'm not going to have a hotel with a pillow, right? So far, I've made sure I did, because I'm not that young anymore either. And I've earned my comfort, right?
That's right. That's right.
And so that's what I want. But I feel like the audience that's watching feels the same way. A lot of them feel the same way. I'm sure there's many more brave people than me out there watching who might even be laughing at me, which is fine as long as they laugh. But you know, your kids, you're looking for something to watch with your kids. I can't tell you how many toddlers and people of all ages have responded to me with the show.
Yeah.
Because all it is the food. It's not even about the food. Food is part of it because I understand that food is something that everyone likes and everybody's got to eat. So it's instantly relatable. Okay. And we all love it. There's not a culture on the earth that doesn't think they love food more than everyone else.
That's right.
Oh, you haven't eaten until you went to a Chinese person's house. Oh, you can't believe it. If you come to a Greek person's house, you won't believe how much food we're all the same. So I see food as the great connector between people, and then laughs are the cement.
Let me ask you this. As you're prepping to be a host,
yes,
and you've obviously at this point watched Bourdain, you've probably watched many of these food shows at this point as you were prepping for this.
I wasn't prepping. It just was something that was on, and I got it. I liked Bourdain the most because he was genuine, and he was like a superhero to me.
But did you, and I'm curious about this, as the man who was eating all the food in every episode.
Yeah.
Did you study the art of the on-camera bite?
No.
So
Which
this was
is why maybe it doesn't look so good. I don't know. Maybe I could bite better. But I know for sure that if I studied it, I'd become self-conscious in that.
But not everybody can pull it off, Phil. That's what I'm saying. It's all in the eyes and in the teeth. Not everybody can pull it off.
I'm just eating. Don't make me self-conscious now.
No.
That there's no acting on the show.
No.
I'd say the most that I think about being performative is that in the way we all are, if someone had just cooked something for you and you ate it in front of them, at the bare minimum, you must be polite. You would never spit something out in front of somebody who just cooked for you, right?
Right.
I mean, that's unless you're an animal.
Correct.
But I am aware of that, but only as a human being, not as a performer, not like an on-screen persona. And there are times when I'm given something that wasn't cooked by someone in front of me, and you'll see my honest reaction. That's my brother's favorite part. He's the producer. You can hear him laughing because when I eat something very, very bad, we leave it in.
I speaking of your brother, I watched the last episode you guys did this past season that was dedicated to your parents to Helen and Max. And it's just to say it's touching would be an understatement. And I couldn't, because it's been so long since I read your book, that I didn't realize the parallels of the sibling rivalry and the favorite son in your in your own sibling dynamic with your brother, as it equated to, you know, the characters in Everybody Loves Raymond. Like, I had completely forgotten about that.
So I got to tell you, it wasn't until just a couple of years ago, maybe, that I realized I must have chosen the title.
Oh my God.
Everybody Loves Raymond. Everybody Loves Raymond is something that Ray's real life cop brother said about him. Oh, it never ends for Raymond. He said, I go to work, people shoot at me. Right? Raymond, yeah. Raymond goes to work, they laugh, they you know, they do. He really said that. It never ends for Raymond. Everybody loves Raymond. And my wife said that should be the title of the show, right? And I said, yeah, I can't think of a better one. I love it. And what I love about it is it harkens back to I Love Lucy. So we know we're in that world of old-fashioned type of sitcom, right?
Yep.
And it's very specific. It's the brother's point of view. The brother is saying it about the sibling that everyone loves. And it's also the key dilemma of the show. Raymond is being pulled from every direction because everyone loves him so much, right? And that's his curse.
That's right.
His curse. His mother loves him so much. His wife loves him so much. Be on my side. Be on my side.
Yep.
And the jealousy of the brother. And I didn't realize till a couple of years ago, this is why I identified with that title, because I was always saying everybody loves Richard. As soon as Richard came along, the young, cuter brother.
That's right.
I had been replaced in my own show, which That's was right. House at 5 years old.
You didn't put that together until the last 2 years?
No, that's how blind we are to our own things, right?
That's amazing.
It never, I did it for all the reasons I said just before this.
Right.
But it never occurred to me that I had a deep psychological reason.
Right, on a visceral level, why it connected with you. Exactly. We mentioned classic TV, and I have a little game I want to play with you that connects classic TV to food in a second. But before we do that, along the lines of classic TV, can I just say thank you for bringing back the theme song and the opening titles?
Never underestimate the power of a theme song. As a matter of fact, when I moved from PBS to Netflix, I had the nicest meeting I've ever had in show business. And it was Ted Sarandos literally asked me this question. Was there anything on the show you did over there that you didn't have that you would like to have here? Now, how beautiful is that to say to somebody in a meeting?
How rare do you ever get a network person asking, what do you want? What do you want?
That never happens. And you know what I said? I'd like a theme song. He said, go ahead. So I'd met this band, Lake Street Dive. They are awesome.
Yeah.
And they were the first people I called. I said, would you even be interested in doing a theme song? They said, yeah, what'd you have in mind? I wrote some lyrics.
Oh, okay.
They wrote additional, better lyrics and that catchy song. The best thing about the show, I think.
I kind of got a Carole King vibe from it.
It's fantastic. And the lead singer, Rachel Price, if people are listening and they only know Lake Street Dive for my theme song, just go on Spotify or Apple iTunes and just download an album or two of Lake Street Dive. You will be thrilled at how great that band is.
It made me miss the era of the classic opening theme song, like Mary Tyler Moore and others. So this is a game I want to play with you if you're up for it. I'm going to name a classic TV show.
Yeah.
And I want you to tell me the perfect food pairing for that TV show that comes to mind.
Goodness, I don't think this way, but go ahead.
It's like, have you seen the movie City Slickers with Ira and Barry, the ice cream guys? Okay. And they say they can make the perfect ice cream pairing for any dish.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
That's-
Yeah. I don't want to do that, but I'm going to name a classic TV show and you tell me what you think, what dish. It could be an appetizer. It doesn't have to be a full meal.
Got it. Just the first food that comes to mind when you're
the spiritual food companion.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Got it.
Brady Bunch.
Apple pie.
Great. All in the Family.
Oh, I think like a kielbasa from Queens. For Meathead, the Pollock.
I was thinking meatloaf in my head too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh, that's nice. A roast turkey dinner.
That's right. Yep. Yep. Golden Girls.
I'm going to say Bagels and Lox.
All right. Last one. Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Wow. It seems like just make your own ice cream sundae.
Yeah, just a helter skelter.
Just a crazy, like every topping in the world.
All right, last thing, big question for you as you leave. And by the way, thank you for doing this. Thank you for giving me the time on a Friday.
So fun. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to give you a would you rather, okay?
Yeah.
It's an either or here. You can either never eat restaurant food for the rest of your life. That means takeout or going into a restaurant.
Never have restaurant food
or never listen to a Bruce Springsteen song ever again.
Wow. I need the restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because I knew you were a big Bruce guy.
I am a big Bruce guy, but I thought, what could I do without having had a lot of Bruce in my life?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like this choice, but the reason is one of survival that I'm saying this. I need restaurants because I don't really cook.
Never?
Hardly ever. I can make a hot dog, but I need the restaurants for diversity in my life. This is like, it's my world. It's entertainment for me. It's my entertainment life. It's my social life. It's my life because I got to eat. And I love it so much. I can't imagine a world without it. That's why during COVID, when they weren't bailing out, the government wasn't bailing out the independent restaurants, I was like, damn you. This is the fabric of society.
Yeah.
The diner, right?
That's right.
I'm stupid enough to actually invest in restaurants because I love them so much.
I don't think I knew that. You've invested in multiple restaurants?
Over 25.
For 25 restaurants?
Yeah. And but I support the arts. My wife and I have a foundation that supports the arts. Theater, dance, music, visual arts in school that other administrations have taken out, right?
Mm.
I always say that they think it's the arts are disposable. What they don't realize is it's the answer. This is everything.
Yeah.
We both owe our livelihoods to that arts education. So it's essential to me to support this. And for me, being a chef is one of the arts.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And who's to say that your sense of taste is any less than your sense of sight or sound?
Well, let's think about the joy that would have been taken away from the world had young Phil Rosenthal not had a drama program to enter into young, right?
Exactly right.
To develop your voice.
I owe that theater professor in 1975 everything.
That's right.
David Swift, he's passed on. But, you know, I just loved doing it. And for a skinny little short Jewish kid who was getting beat up on a daily basis, that was my cliched salvation.
Bill, everything turned out okay.
You're never going to talk to a luckier guy than me. I mean, to have had the nice stuff that happened on Raymond, and then now to have this second act where I go around the world with not just the show, but now my book tour, and suddenly at an old age, I'm Harry Styles. Pretty nice.
I mean, you're going to be the Harry Styles of the Real Screen Conference. you're going to be the big fish in a reality TV. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be seeing some friends. I'm going to be catching up with folks. I'm going to be banking some episodes of this. I only do this on the side. I have like an actual TV career, but yeah, I'm going to be there seeing folks.
That's nice.
Right. I'll run into you. I'll say hi.
That's so nice. All right.
Thanks for doing this, Phil.
My absolute pleasure.
Have a great weekend.
You too.